Hello everyone, I hope you're having a wonderful summer and enjoying whatever weather you have on offer in whichever country you're in. I am joined by Fleur Thomas, who was appointed Her Majesty's Ambassador to the Grand Duchy of Luxembourg. It was Her Majesty's Ambassador back in April 2021. And since then, so much has happened in the years since you've been Ambassador, Fleur Thomas, here in Luxembourg. Prior to this, of course, just a little bit of background for you. You were previously the head of exports in the Ministry of Defence. You joined the Foreign and Commonwealth Office in 2020, having previously worked as a senior civil servant in the Ministry of Defence and Department for International Trade, and as a director in an arm's length body in the Ministry of Defence. And you started working as a part-time Crown servant in 2002. And before that, a whole variety of... I've done a deep dive. I mean...
Oh gosh, you've done your homework.
I did a bit of homework. Your background is not the straightforward path one would imagine to becoming an ambassador.
No, but we're not all fortunate enough to have the best start with everything in life, and not everything always goes right the first time.
So, which I think is a wonderful example to maybe speak to.
So whilst I've had a fantastically supportive family environment, I would say I sort of wasn't born with a silver spoon in my mouth, and I didn't always make the right career choices and career decisions early on. So you know, you have to make the best way that you can, and do what you can to educate yourself, to put yourself into jobs that you might want to do.
And well, you've become ambassador here in Luxembourg, and you've been here, as mentioned, since 2021. So how did you change that path for yourself? Because I think it's very interesting, and I know you're a mentor for so many people in a variety of ways. How did you make that path for yourself?
So it's probably worth saying that I did a very vocational degree, which led to being what we would call in the UK a chartered surveyor. And I suffered really bad sexual harassment in that job. And it wasn't ever called sexual harassment then. And this is the mid-90s. There was nobody really to report it to. There was no pathway you could go. I was the only female graduate. It was really, really tough. And I didn't know what to do. So I just said it wasn't working. And I left after 6 months. So I was then left with a vocational degree and no job, essentially. So I actually decided I was going to need to re-educate myself with masters in order to be able to do that. But I come from a working class / lower middle class background. So actually the reality is that you can't just decide you're going to take yourself off to university and do a master's. So I studied with the Open University. And so I worked as a cabin crew for British Airways whilst I was studying. And I gained two master's degrees because I probably felt that, and I think this is perhaps indicative of people who don't necessarily have the right background, that you're never quite good enough, and maybe only one master's degree isn't enough. So I studied for a master's in an MSc in development management and also an MBA. And that then gave me credibility with other employers to do other things. And that's when I joined the civil service.
Do you think the education was important for your confidence or for future employers?
I think a bit of both. I probably didn't need two master's degrees plus my original degree. But actually... I think it's not any education really helps, I think.
And then to the perhaps more important point, that which you're a very open person, it seems, with so many topics, the sexual harassment, which, yes, I remember the 90s, we didn't talk about things in the same way as we do now.
No.
That must have been extremely difficult. And the fact that you were not supported and... You know, there was not the joy given to the only female graduate of your course, you know, and no applause for that necessarily, but the opposite reaction, in fact. And then you didn't feel you could stay within that career.
No.
That is very... Has that changed for chartered surveyors?
I think so. I think it's a lot better now. You see it across the board. And I'm glad that it's changed. I'm glad it's better for other people.
But you've stayed in what are not typically female professions.
I know. It's a very strange thing. But I did go to... I was not very happy at school when I was younger. And I was often in single-sex schools. And I didn't particularly flourish. I did much better when I was then in a school which was co-ed. And then my university course was 95% men. So actually, I was quite used to being in a male environment, but it was people who were much, much older than me who were, if you like, the people causing the problems rather than people of my own age. It wasn't a peer group problem. It was much more senior people. So yeah, I it never really put me off working in male environments. I was just more cautious. And I think as I got older as well, you just get more used to dealing with difficulties and bypassing things. And now you don't. I don't have to do that because now I'm 50 and no one looks twice at you. You're sort of, you know, it's a different world. You know, if you become senior, you become older, you don't have the problems.
Well, there's so many things there. Just going back to perhaps who it was that caused the problems, I hope it was not the teaching staff.
No, not at university. This was at the first firm I worked at. Yeah.
Well, we'll park that because things have changed. Mm-hmm. But then with a variety of careers, including British Airways cabin crew, yeah. Which, I mean, just makes me smile to think of it, actually. You did end up in the Ministry of Defence.
Yes.
And you've held a number of positions there. And again, this is a place where there are not so many female leading figures. And within that, you have given so much to other women, but not just women as well. You are the gender champion in the MOD. Mm-hmm. You promote gender balance, diversity, right across what is obviously a traditionally male environment. Mm-hmm. We all know that. Also, the social mobility part. Both of those are very, very important. And I mean, you're an example of it yourself, but this intersectional diversity, that's very important for you to talk about.
Yes, it is. It always has been. And I think partly because when I was going through those sort of postgraduate years as an early employee, there weren't people talking about it. And you very much felt unusual. You know, it was the things like not going on the skiing holidays and everybody else coming back and they had been on skiing holidays, whereas we couldn't afford to go on skiing holidays. So it's those kind of small things that then people get those networks. So I think it's super important to help people who don't have those networks to be able to build their own networks, to build networks with senior people as well, so that they become more at ease with the working world.
And then for the advice you give these people as a supporter, as a champion, as a mentor for these people, how can one create those networks? Are there more available opportunities to these people?
There are some really good schemes now within government, for sure. But there's been something called the Catapult Scheme, which has been aiming at social mobility individuals, so people who do not come from conventional backgrounds. Aiming to give them mentoring, aiming to give them career coaching, aiming to give them more support. The fact that they have mentors, I think, is also really helpful. You know, providing they're the right mentors, of course, that's another thing, which, you know, it can take a while to get the right relationships in place. But also the networks for themselves of the social mobility CADA, and the Foreign Office has that as a social mobility network within it. And I've given a session on for them as well, talking about my background, because people who are not ambassadors, people who are coming through the department who are much, much younger, need to see that there are people who don't come from conventional backgrounds, perhaps didn't go to the right universities or do the right courses that you expect people to have done who are ambassadors, can get to the top of those careers.
And why does it matter? I mean, that is a very basic question. I can think of many answers, but what difference does it really make that you can see and feel?
I think diversity of thought is super important. So I think if you have people who are all very similar in a room, whatever that might be, talking about a topic, they will very likely come out with the same solution if there's an issue. Whereas I think if you have people from different backgrounds, you will inevitably get different suggestions. And I think that's incredibly powerful and incredibly important.
And for something, an institution as established, as anchored as the Ministry of Defence, where it has been very male. I don't even know what the split is right now, actually. I'm sure you know what the split is. Well, actually, what is the split?
I'm not sure, if I'm honest. I'm not working for them at the moment. But I know that it's going to take many, many years for you to have equality, because the Ministry of Defence works in a way where you have civil servants and alongside military. And whilst we don't have as many military women joining at the lower ranks, and obviously many leave when they have children, the numbers at the top are less. So you've already got this kind of decreasing number on the military side, and I'm afraid that's rather matched on the civil service side, about the same. And my last team of, you know, 20 something was all men.
So you haven't really changed from the chartered surveyor days. I'm thinking back to, but at least it sounds like you found a place where you fitted.
Yes.
And people were supportive of you.
I think it's a place where if you work hard and you work well with the team, you manage your team well, then you are respected for it. I think hard work is respected, and I don't mind hard work. So if I'm in a place where hard work is respected, that's fine, because I can work hard, anyone can work hard, and that's acceptable, and that's fine for me.
Well, on that front as well, with the Ministry of Defence, you are the gender champion there, and this is a very important role for you. And alongside the diversity of well, let's call it class, for want of a better word, for people who haven't had the opportunity mm-hmm. to go on the skiing holidays, etc. The gender diversity is very, very important. And that's something that's been in conversation, let's say, for at least the last decade. And yeah. some wonderful photos of you with Boy George that are seared into my brain. Fabulous photos. But this is another very important diversity of thought.
Yes, absolutely. And I think that we need to welcome people into the workplace who feel comfortable to be who they are. And it's just as far as it goes for me. I mean, I sometimes think we think a lot about this and we talk a lot about this, but it doesn't make any difference to me whether you're lesbian or trans. It doesn't matter to me. If you do your job well, if you work effectively, then that's all I'm interested in, really.
You know? Then should we be talking about it anymore?
I think we need to, because there are people who don't think like that. And I think we need to make sure that everybody has that way of thinking, if you like, mm-hmm. And that there are not the problems that there are. And we know that people are still killed for being LGBT+, for example.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and in some places. So there isn't equality, and that still happens in some countries other than, let's say, somewhere like Uganda, where we know there are death penalties. But in European countries, there are still people being discriminated against in the worst possible ways.
In your experience of the MOD, and even going back to your student days as well, where there has not been present that diversity of gender or whatever the diversity of their sexuality is, or even that intersectional diversity of social mobility, say, what examples can you bring to tell us where it's made a difference?
I used to, it's not necessarily an example, but I used to not say very much about my background. I used to be someone who would just be fairly quiet about things. And I don't think that was very healthy for me. So I think the fact that people can be open about who they are is really, really important. And I didn't have something which, you know, I might have felt that I really needed to hide, but I certainly wouldn't have said, oh, well, we don't go on family skiing holidays because we can't afford it. I'd have just said, oh, well, we don't ski in my family. You know, so there's that difference. But I know it's much, much harder for LGBT people, perhaps, whose families wouldn't accept them. And that those are much more difficult decisions to make about what you hide and what you come out with publicly.
So it's both freeing for you, and it also helps other people. And is that one reason why you're so open in general? It strikes me in my correspondence with you, you've always been very, very open. What was the change for you? Because as you said also, you were not always open. What triggered that for you?
I'm not sure there was a trigger as such, but I definitely think that if I give the example of when I was cabin crew, the male stewards, many of whom were gay, not all, but many of whom were gay, were always terribly kind. And I heard terrible stories from some of them about how their families had totally rejected them, how they were living with friends, sofa surfing, because they'd been thrown out by their families. And I think that really affected me deeply, because these were people who were then very kind to me. So maybe that was something that really made me think about this a lot more. But I just think also getting older and you in a more senior position, you have a voice. Where when you're younger and you're in your 20s and you don't really have that voice. You certainly didn't when I was in my 20s, because there wasn't all the social media. People behave in a different way now because there's social media. You can be an influencer in your 20s or in your teens. That wasn't the case when I was 20. So, I think things have changed.
I think things have changed quite a lot. So let's bring it right back up to Luxembourg. You've been here for the last 3 years. An awful lot has happened in the last 3 years. Yeah. I mean, a huge amount. If we think back to, I was reading some articles and interviews you'd done back in, just when you'd arrived actually mm-hmm. in May 2021. And then so much has changed. Let's just talk about newsworthy. Well, and I mean, even there a lot has changed. But you've hosted some amazing events here for sad and wonderful reasons. Mm-hmm. So talk us through some of them. I mean, let's start with the royal family.
So yes, I had the great honour of hosting a Jubilee birthday party. So we always have was Her Majesty the Queen's birthday party, which we host. It's now His Majesty the King's birthday party, of course. But we had the Jubilee party, and connected to that on a separate occasion, I also hosted His Royal Highness the Grand Duke at the residence. The staff on my team, Lara, had produced an exhibition of photographs of the two royal families, which really focused on the 1973 and 1976 visits, but also going back and other weddings and other events that they had attended. And His Royal Highness came and had a look at that exhibition and had tea with me in the garden. And that was a really special moment.
And actually, speaking of tea, just to interject a little bit, I know that cooking is very, very important to you. Apparently, yes. You arrived with over 200 cookbooks, yes. I read in one interview, and that you'd given your own in this set of initial interviews. Whatever the cake recipe was your cake recipe.
Yeah, there's been a bit of that, I'm afraid. I feel slightly sorry for the chef sometimes.
I think you'll have to pass on a recipe before you leave, your favourite cake recipe.
I'm sure I can do that.
But moving back to the royal family events, of course, then very sadly, Her Majesty died.
Yes, and that was quite shocking and quite difficult, I suppose, in that, you know, we are half-masting the flags at the residence and the embassy. And then we are hosting a condolence book at the embassy, which I staffed, I would say, for 80-85% of the time that we opened it. So for those 10 days that we were open, including over parts of the weekends, I was just there in mourning, receiving people. And that was a huge honour, actually, to see how many people came to pay their respects to Her Late Majesty. That was really quite something. And we had people who came from immense distances, brought their families from across France or Germany, you know, to sign a book because they felt it was really important. So that was a moment where it really felt quite special. And then
I was just going to say, I imagine through those 10 days where you were present so much of the time, you heard some stories where people had met her, no doubt.
Yes, where people had met her or just people who felt that they'd lost somebody, like losing a grandmother or a relative, you know, people who were genuinely very, very distraught. So that was, you know, amazing for them to share their grief in that way with us as a team.
Yeah. And then, of course, you had to accompany the Grand Duke over to the UK.
Well, and on at the airport, yes, which was, again, an honour to be with their Royal Highnesses for a period of time before their journey. And we then hosted a commemorative event at the cathedral with the kind permission of the Catholic Church, which was amazing, actually, to be able to host an Anglican service there, during which we had multi-faith contributions, which I thought was quite important. And it was amazingly well attended. And that was a real honour to do. And one thing you never want to do, of course, you never want to even think about doing something like that. But when you do it, it's a really special moment.
But I can even hear with the faith, you're bringing in the diversity element. Everything is the openness and the diversity of faith, the diversity of culture, diversity of thought. It's really a theme in your life.
It is, but I do think it's also very related to the way that the UK is. It's the modern UK. You know, we may not think of, if you think about an ambassador, you might not necessarily think about an ambassador as you think about the modern UK. And we represent the modern UK. And these are elements that I think of when I think of the UK.
And then, of course, the flip side of Her Majesty's death is the fact that we have a new king.
Indeed, yes. Yeah. And again, we had a huge event here for that as well. And I came to speak to you just a few days before that.
I remember.
Yeah. So we had the big event at St. George's School, to whom I'm very grateful for being able to host that event alongside some of the other British organisations here in Luxembourg. And that was a very special day, very busy day too.
And then, of course, alongside all of those duties, you have hosted some incredible people during your time here.
Yes, I've been very, very fortunate. You mentioned Boy George. I think that was definitely a highlight.
The photos from that.
Yeah, I know. Well, he was singing to me. I mean, you know, I'm the right era, right? This is completely, Culture Club is completely my era. So, that was a bit of I was still a bit of a sort of teenage groupie, I think, at that moment. But yes, we've been very, very lucky with people who come and see us or people who allow us access to them when they're here. I saw Anna Lapwood only recently, and some of the ballet companies who've been through have been extraordinary.
Yeah, the Birmingham Ballet Company was
they're amazing with Black Sabbath. That was very cool. Yeah.
Very unusual one. Mm. And then, of course, during this time, bringing back to your work within the ministry, we've had the whole Ukrainian war start.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I know this is something that you, well, everybody cares about it deeply, but you have intrinsic knowledge of what's going on from a defence point of view. And indeed, you wrote an article for RTL, an open opinion piece in May just this year. And with that phrase that many of us know, but just to reiterate it, if you want peace, prepare for war, which is something that you will always have known. But I think for so many Europeans, we lived thinking that was it. You know, the end of the world wars, that was it. But not so.
It's interesting because I probably didn't personally feel like that. I had been part of an actually unsuccessful campaign to sell Typhoon Eurofighter fighter planes to Finland. And in fact, they purchased F-35, the American planes, which is fine.
You might be the only BA cabin crew to have ever done this.
Yeah, for sure. Because of that, I had a lot of engagement with the Finnish military over an extended period of time. And their model, if you like, is that we need to be able to defend ourselves without support from others, because at the time they were not a NATO member, of course. Mm-hmm. And they were genuinely preparing for the fact that Russia might invade them.
And which year was this?
This is only a few years ago. This is 6 years ago, probably.
So they felt something was changing.
I think they've always felt that there was a threat. And they didn't feel that that threat was getting any better. So for me, you know, hearing that from countries like Finland and other countries, we'd worked with Poland on ground-based weapons systems as well. This was not an unfamiliar concern coming from countries in closer proximity to Russia.
But that's you working within the Ministry of Defence, yeah, being on the ground, hearing those conversations.
Yes.
To the wider public, that conversation was not getting airtime.
No. Possibly not as much as it could have done, yeah.
And so now we're in the situation we're in. Yeah. What are your thoughts on it?
I mean, obviously, like everybody, I think it's terrible. Any loss of life in warfare is an awful thing on both sides. But only one side started this. One side provoked it. One side is invading the country of another sovereign nation. So therefore, genuinely, my heart and my thoughts are completely with the Ukrainians. I'm wearing a band on my wrist today. You know, I don't go out anytime. No, you'll always see me with a something Ukrainian, because genuinely we need to stand with them. And if that's a symbol that matters to them, and I know it does, then that's something we should all be doing.
You've mentioned in this piece that you wrote for RTL in May this year, of course, we've had a number of countries that have increased or will increase defence funding. It went down quite low when we thought we were living in a long era of peacetime. Mm-hmm. Do you think it's enough? So, for instance, at the time it was Rishi Sunak, he said he would boost defence spending. It will increase, it will add another $75 billion between now and 2030. With the aim to spend 2.5% of its GDP in defence. I don't know if this will change with the new government, but it seems that many, many European countries, the idea to increase GDP for defence is absolutely on the manifestos.
Yes, absolutely, because I think it's when you see the threat, you recognise it's a problem. We're now in a position where many stockpiles are exhausted. I mean, you might not think about it, but we usually have stockpiles of weapons.
I never used to think that this is correct. I didn't go around thinking about weaponry stockpiles ever.
Yeah, and they go out of date as well, and they need refilling. You know, missiles need refill. So there's things that need doing so that you always have an active and capable defence force, not just in terms of people, but in terms of equipment. And we are all thinking about that much more actively now. And yes, for sure, you're seeing, you've seen commitments from our new government as well on this, and very early engagements from our ministers, both in Ukraine and with visitors to the UK. We've seen Zelensky address cabinet. He's the first person to address cabinet, this first foreign official, I think, or foreign elected individual to address cabinet this century. So, you know, that's a big deal. We obviously the government is taking it very seriously.
And then there is also cyber defence and cyber attacks, which is a completely other side, a more silent side, until it affects all of our lives because we're all attached to this.
Well, we say other side. It's actually very much knitted together. So we have units within our armed forces who focus on countering cyber threats.
I just mean other in that it's not a physical entity.
Yeah, it's hard. It's hard to understand it or to see it unless you're a hacker or a computer expert, for sure. Yeah.
So, if somebody wanted to work in defence, What areas of defence do you think need people and what skills are needed?
Well, we need people everywhere, really. And pretty much anything you want to do, if you see the adverts for working in the armed forces, it says, you know, if you want to be a chef, you can join the armed forces. If you want to be a logistician, if you want to be a strategist, if you want to be a pilot, you know, any of these areas in terms of joining the military. But it's pretty well matched within the civil service. You know, we have procurement experts. So there's a massive procurement programs that we have, not unlike what you see in NSPA here in Luxembourg, but within near Bristol. Then you have pretty much every corporate function that you could imagine. So if you want to be an HR specialist in defence, we've got them. So you think about any kind of area. You know, my expertise was really in defence exports and defence industrialisation overseas. That's not something that I would have thought is something I would ever have ended up doing, but it's something that I particularly enjoy, and I think it's very worthwhile.
And really quite a change from chartered surveying.
Yes. But, you know, people sort of say, you know, you think, what do you want to do? They always say to young kids, what do you want to do? I wanted to be a librarian and look what I've ended up doing now. And I guess you could ask me the question, so what do you want to do? I'll tell you when I know.
But it's also a great exercise in having the example of somebody who's changed their career so many times in so many different ways and been, well, through hard work, I have no doubt, been given the opportunity by people who recognised something in you that was strong.
Yeah, clearly I know I have a lot of determination. I do devote myself quite hard to work. Whatever I do, I want to do it well. So there are people who will have recognised that in other things I've done and kind of gone, oh, yes, you know, we'll go with this person. But yeah, sometimes it's a bit of luck involved as well, to be honest.
Well, you are clearly a hard worker, because the other thing that happened during this time, which you've been open about and you're kind enough to speak about, is your journey through cancer. And when I'm reading about your experience of cancer, you had extraordinary levels of work before diagnosis, through diagnosis, yeah. Post-diagnosis. Most people who are dealing with cancer try to close down work. You didn't have that chance, or chose not to.
I chose not to. So it's not fair to say I couldn't do it. The Foreign Office absolutely gave me that opportunity. I hadn't been feeling well for a long time. And I just felt drained, tired, and fatigued in the way that teenagers never want to get out of bed. I felt like that. I was setting the snooze button on my alarm every 5 minutes. And this is from someone who used to get up at quarter to five in the morning to go to work in my last job in London. So that was not normal for me. I had a biopsy of my thyroid. I had, in the end, a papillary thyroid cancer, but I had a biopsy on the 20th of April last year. And then my diagnosis was on the 2nd of May. Now, you'll be not unaware that the coronation was on the 6th of May. So I hosted that huge event at St. George's School only a handful of days after my diagnosis. Fortunately, I then flew that day in the afternoon for a week's holiday, because I just needed some processing time. But I just kind of went through those few days. I actually did an interview here, I think, during that period.
You did?
Yeah. But just got on with it, because what else do you do? You just get on with it. You know, I didn't want cancer to stop my life. It is what it is. And I was lucky enough, you know, it was very efficient in Luxembourg. I had my first surgery on the 7th of June, so only a month after diagnosis. And on the 15th of June, I had the King's birthday party, and then I had the Minister for Europe visiting. And, you know, we don't get that many ministers visiting Luxembourg. So when I did have a minister visiting, I absolutely wanted to be leading that visit, because it was for bilateral discussions with Luxembourg that I felt were really important. So, yeah, I got out of bed and did it. That's what you do.
Not everybody does this.
Maybe I think it's maybe a bit of, you know, I've never served in the military, but I've worked for a long time alongside them, and I probably a little bit's rubbed off on me on that kind of thing.
Well, I think it's just the graft. You've always had that in you from everything that you've described. You've had that absolute determination of mind and body, it would seem. But just to go back, for anybody who may feel fatigued, thyroid cancer is not one that I hear about so often. Can you give us any examples of what a person should look out for, just in case?
So you can have lumps in your neck. I'm not sure whether I did or not, really, because by the time I knew to look for lumps in my neck, you then start kind of almost imaginary feeling them, because you don't really know. It's absolute exhaustion. And they can pick some of this up with blood tests, and then others with having to take a biopsy on your thyroid. But they'd shown on ultrasound that I had thyroid nodules. Now, often thyroid thyroid can be shown by, underactive thyroid can be shown by weight gain, sluggishness, fatigue, just feeling generally quite rubbish. And actually some of those symptoms also combine with menopause. So actually women can often be told, oh, well, that's probably menopause. I knew in my case, because I'd gone through very early menopause, that it was not menopause, because I'd already been on that journey and was on HRT and had been for some years. So I knew that wasn't what it was for me, but I know some people, they can be told that that's what it is. 3 times more women than men get thyroid cancer. So it's actually something that generally hits women at their late 40s, early 50s. So I was spot on exactly when it should have been found. But it had probably been there for quite some years before they found it.
And do they know why it's more women than men?
No.
They don't know yet.
No.
Okay, so we have that. Then you posted some pictures of the, what I believe to be radiotherapy pictures,
yeah,
of the area, which I know from family experiences, it's brutal.
So I had what they call radioactive iodine therapy, which actually is not as bad as radiotherapy, but it just makes you feel really terrible. So, you're in isolation for 3 days in the hospital because you are radioactive, because you actually take orally in your mouth a tablet of radioactivity, and it contains radioactive iodine. But before you take the tablet, they give you a couple of injections which removes all your thyroid function, which just makes you feel shocking, like you don't want to get up off the floor, sort of shocking. You do feel pretty rubbish, to be honest. It's bad. And I had a second surgery because I had a lump on my lung, and that was pretty nasty to recover from as well. So I had 2 surgeries and then this treatment. But I was back at work. I'm looking at the date. So 21st of August, I came back to work. So,
well, you'd never really left work by this
time. Well, not really. But, yeah, I had a bit of time off in July because I had to have daily physiotherapy to teach me how to breathe properly again.
So you were diagnosed in the May?
In April. Biopsy on 20th of April, diagnosis 2nd of May, and I was back to work on the 21st of August, yeah.
That is an extraordinarily short period of time.
Yes, it was great because it meant I could get back to work. I know. I should have probably taken a bit more time off, but, you know, it is what it is.
Most people, again, who I know who go through cancer, you described the fatigue before it, they also talk about a period of maybe 2 years afterwards where they don't feel themselves.
I feel better now than I did before the cancer. So, I mean, maybe I was just feeling so rubbish beforehand. The cancer was making me feel so terrible that actually, I mean, really days afterwards, I felt better.
And where do you get this absolute, you know, mind, it seems mind over body strength?
I don't know. I mean, my mother's mother, my grandmother, was a very, very strong woman. She had 5 children and she was widowed at a very young age while she had babe in arms kind of thing. One of her children died. Her husband had died when she was young. She had lived in a council house. She was evicted by... it was not a council house at the time. She was in a tied cottage because her husband worked in a rural occupation. He was a cow herder. So she was evicted with these children and went to the local MP's office and was given a council house. So she's got grit. She, you know, my grandmother had grit, and I was very close to her, and I used to attend church with her every Sunday when I was a child. I'd like to think I'm a little bit like my grandmother.
She had the wherewithal to go to the local MP,
yeah,
even.
Yeah, so with her 5 children in tow.
It also shows, I mean, it also shows...
Which I love about her, you know, that's a wonderful thing about her.
Well, I mean, it also shows that she knew politics had power.
She knew that she had to get help, I guess, and I had no idea who told her that that's where she should go. I'm sure somebody must have helped her to tell her where to go, but, you know, the landowner for whom the house was tied, new cow herder is coming in, you're kicked out, you know. It must have been devastating, must have been absolutely devastating. I don't know how she... you know, recovered and lived her life, and she cleaned houses to make money. You know, she was a really hardworking lady. But I've always been brought up, you know, with a very supportive family, and the value of hard work, that's important.
Just, it circles back to the start of your story where you said, you know, not everybody who works at the MOD goes to the right university, whatever that means, or et cetera, goes on the skiing holidays, et cetera. But it sounds to me that your journey of hard work has been one of just leaps and bounds of changing steps in life that was unimaginable to your grandmother.
Yes, yes. I wish she could see me now. You know, genuinely, I wish she could see me making a speech at the King's birthday party, because I know she'd be immensely proud of that. She wouldn't have understood it because it would have been so far outside of her sphere. But no, I know she would be proud. But yes, it's so far outside the sphere of my understanding. You know, when I was working as cabin crew, I was watching shows like The West Wing, and that's the first I'd have heard about being an ambassador. I would never have thought about that before then, because it was not within my social sphere at all. I didn't know anyone who was a civil servant. So and why would you become one?
Where did the idea of being an ambassador come from? Was it something that you thought about when you were within the MOD?
Yes. Yeah. I've worked very closely with some of our ambassadors, some fantastic people in Finland, in Poland in particular, I'd say, you know, a great woman, actually.
And that's when you were travelling, you saw women in this position.
I saw some women in these positions. I saw a lot of men in these positions as well. We're quite good at this now in the Foreign Office. We've got quite a lot of females as ambassadors, and in some of our, if you like, most visible posts as well, you'll see quite a lot of men are rulings. My colleague at the moment in Paris because of the Olympic Games. Yes, you know, we've got really strong women in those jobs, which is good. But it was less about being a woman to get the jobs, but it was actually coming from another department, which is actually another sort of difficulty, because it's much harder if you're not a career diplomat to get these jobs.
Yeah, because you weren't within the Foreign Office.
Yes, exactly.
Which is the more usual route.
Yes, yes. So I applied for the job. Anyone across government can apply for the jobs. And it's not that it didn't have lots of applicants. It had an awful lot of applicants, but I just was fortunate enough to get the job. So, yeah.
Well, I think you certainly stand out for having the most unusual background, I'm sure, of the crop.
we have a few like that. There's another ambassador I know who co-owns a microbrewery with her husband and has worked in bars. So, you know, there's a few of us around with a slightly different, perhaps slightly different view on life and a slightly different background, which is good.
Which is a very good thing. And that brings me right back to your cooking when you drove over from the article I read, it was shoes and cookbooks, and you like to go foraging.
Yes,
also.
Yes. I haven't had much. I haven't had enough free time here, really. But yes, I used to gather a lot of mushrooms and fruits and make my own jams and chutneys in the UK. But it's here I tend to work a lot more weekends, so there's a lot less time to do that. I did make some sea buckthorn jelly last season when I was up in the Netherlands with my partner. We made some sea buckthorn jelly, which was quite good. That's very high in vitamin C.
You might need to tell people what sea buckthorn is.
It's a very, very thorny bush, which has very, very golden yellow berries on it, which grows near the coastline. You'll see it in the Dutch Junelands, if you like. And you have to harvest it with a bag and using a fork, because you can't actually put your fingers on it because it's such a thorny plant. Buckthorn gives you the clue. And you have to then sort of boil this stuff up and then put it through a sieve. It's all quite fun, you know.
This is really rather unusual. Have you ever thought, it sounds like you could go in any direction, Ambassador. I mean, have you ever thought about launching your own cookbook?
No. No, I don't. I like cooking. I like doing it for fun. It's not something I ever want to make part of my work.
Well, it can be fun. A cookbook can still be fun.
Yeah, maybe. I don't know. I'm not sure anyone would buy it, though, Lisa, to be fair. Oh,
actually, well, I think you'd be surprised. The last ambassador had a book out.
That's true. That's true, but it had relevance to Luxembourg rather than a personal. Yeah.
Well, you could have relevance in what you forage.
Yeah, that's true.
It could be from the ground here. Yeah. But the other thing you do is design cushions.
Yeah, I do quite a lot of needlepoint. When I used to, that was my lockdown go-to. I've done needlepoint over the years, and sewing and knitting and things.
Again, a very creative hobby.
Yes, but that comes from really both my parents are quite creative in that sort of way. My father does woodworking and has actually made lace. My mother has done sewing, knitting, amazing knitting, ferrule knitting, lace knitting and things like that. So that's always been in the family as well. And I think, again, comes from the fact that, you know, if you want something nice, you make it yourself because you can't afford to buy it. And I think, you know, sometimes where that's your background, that's just what you do. You know, I don't ever remember not being able to sew on a button, for example. You know?
Well, again, you would be surprised perhaps at how many of us don't quite know how to do that or do it very badly, which would be me. These are skills that not all of us do acquire from our parents.
Yeah. Yeah. But for me, it was, that was something that was, I don't remember not doing it.
Well, your parents, again, credit to them.
They're amazing people.
And the other description I have, you know, it was a beautiful, I must say, the article. It was so wonderful because it described the variety of cookbooks, the designer cushions that you had made, accompanied by models of fighter jets and a meteor air-to-air missile.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm very proud of those.
A very odd collection of items.
Yeah, I know it's an odd collection, but it's kind of representative of me, you know, perhaps slightly odd, Lisa, and that's okay. I don't mind being slightly odd. Unusual is not a bad thing.
Well, I mean, we want to hope that you've enjoyed your time here in Luxembourg.
Loved it. It's been brilliant, actually. Yes. I don't yet know when I'll be leaving, but I know it will be by March next year. So definitely my last summer. I've loved it here. People have been fantastic. The government's been really easy to work with. I've had brilliant colleagues. The team,
the government here, it's
yes,
been changing over
yeah. there. Yeah, no, the government here has been brilliant to work with. And actually, this is an exciting time now because with a new government coming in, of course, there'll be changes in policy and changes in emphasis. So this is also an exciting time for whoever comes next.
And what is next for you?
I don't know yet. Back to defence to do something. We'll wait and see.
Well, I think there's quite a lot in defence needing your help.
Well, I would like to think so. I like to think there's a place for me somewhere. I haven't got a fixed idea. Just ideas about what I would like to do, but we'll see what comes next.
And if you had any reflections on Luxembourg, what would they be? What comes to mind for you?
People have been very, very kind and generous with their time. The different communities have been incredibly welcoming. And I would say that from the LGBT community, who've been fantastic to me. And I would say that the Catholic Church have been fantastically welcoming to me as well. You know, the Cardinal was very welcoming when I brought the ambassador to the Holy See here. Everybody really, it couldn't be a welcoming, happy place, actually.
And of course, we had the ambassador to the Holy See on this show as well. Yeah. He was great fun as well from the Hopping Festival in Exeter.
He's a lovely man, yes.
Yeah, and he was describing, again, he has a very unusual background if you see the countries he's lived in. So it seems to be in the waters of ambassadorial work. Well, it's been a joy to get to know you over these few years. And we're so happy that you're healthy. And not many of us saw a dent in your energy levels, and we can see why now. It just doesn't, it's not allowed.
No, not really.
in the Thomas genes, it doesn't exist.
No, perhaps not.
But really, thank you so much for your time and everything that you've done for the people, British and others aside, in Luxembourg. And we wish you continued variety of career success as you think about moving back to the UK next year. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Lisa.
The Lisa Burke Show.